WYBC New Haven.
My mom was never one to, like, really stress the whole, like, stranger thing. Partly because, like, she loves hitchhikers and, like, brings them home to our house and things. Like, her idea of stranger, like, you know, when you're young, you're supposed to not get in the car with strangers and things like that. That was not stressed all that much. But I do remember having a consciousness of it, definitely pretty young, because I'm thinking back, and I remember one of my friends, who was a little bit older than me, she and I went to the neighborhood park for the afternoon, and there was snow, we were, like, making snow angels. And this guy driving a Jeep starts, like, circling the park and, like, yelling at us, and we're the only ones at the park. And I remember, like, getting kind of nervous, like, who is this person that we don't know? Why is he doing this? And he stopped his Jeep across the park and he on the other side, and he was, like, yelling across his, come over here, like, I've got a cookie. Like, come over here, girls. And we were just like, he's a stranger. And, like, I must have had this at school or something, but it, like, clicked in my head. And so we just got up and we had snow pants on, and I was, like, running as fast as I could, like, Butch was like, you know, she's like, hurry! She's like 8, and I'm like 4 or 5, like, ah, the stranger! He was like revving his engine and like driving all around. And so that was my first sort of encounter with like strangers and how unpredictable they were. When you were just a young girl and still in school, how come you never learned the golden rule? Don't talk to strangers.
Radley Porch. I'm Rachel Haverford.
And I'm Monty Atkinson. We've all heard it, maybe even said it, stranger equals danger. But isn't everyone you meet a stranger at first? This week, we've gathered some friends together on our porch to talk about the strangers we have met.
We share stories about strangers that creeped us out, strangers that we met while traveling, and stories when the line between strangers and friends becomes a bit blurry.
In second grade, a firefighter came in for to teach us about security and being safe, and he asked us, what does a stranger look like? So we all give, like, answers about someone in shadows or, like these creepy-looking people. And he's like, no, that's not quite what a stranger is. And so we keep giving him answers, and finally he's like, no, a stranger looks like everybody else. And we all, like, freak out at that moment. Or, like, at least in my memory, it's all like, oh my God, he's right. Everyone is a stranger. His thought was that we'd be more careful, but for me, it was kind of the exact opposite, that if everyone's a stranger, and most people are nice and cool and stuff, then most strangers should be okay. And so, but I think, I just remember that being like everyone is a stranger. What do I do now?
Maybe out of, like, hundreds of interactions I had with strangers while traveling, there was one time, really, when that happened, but it was traumatic enough to kind of color a lot of my experience on this particular trip, which is unfortunate. So my friend and I were traveling after studying abroad in northeast China, out west, to a Muslim area where we were sort of warned that things are difficult for women travelers especially, and that we should dress careful, like dress modestly, and try to be careful with strangers there. Advice which we didn't really take seriously. Although my friend was much more worried than I was, I guess based on previous experiences that she'd had, and also she was just much more nervous about trusting strangers and about traveling by ourselves. But anyway, so after spending weeks in this province and relying on strangers for advice, for housing and food, for transportation, for almost everything. We would have done if people hadn't been willing to help us and tell us what to do. And people also warned us that we shouldn't be traveling by ourselves and that we should be careful around strangers. But given that the people who were giving us these warnings were strangers themselves, we didn't really take it seriously. And we were pretty confident that we could get around just by making friends with random people, which we did for the most part, until there was one afternoon when we were actually going to meet a former stranger who is now a friend, and we couldn't get in touch with her, and it was the end of a very long, very hot day. We were very tired. We were in a park, and so our cell phones were out of batteries, and so we were approaching strangers to ask for if we could use our cell phones, and we approached a very kind, grandfatherly-looking old man who was sitting on a bench and didn't speak Mandarin very well, so it was kind of a conversation that was mostly just us, each of us gesturing and laughing a lot and sort of having fun. And my friend was sitting really close to him on the bench and was talking with him and showing him her cell phone and trying to communicate what we needed, even though we knew we probably weren't actually going to get anywhere with this. We were just sort of having fun. And he suddenly, I barely saw what happened, but he reached over and touched her. She leapt up and sort of yelled at me, like, "Margaret, like, what just happened? I can't believe that just happened." And it was so disproportionate to what actually happened, but I think we both felt this, like, wave of panic. Like, we were completely not in control of the situation. And even though this man was, like, half of my height, we turned around and like basically ran away.
Did you say anything to him?
We didn't say anything. I was afraid of him, which is, after I was thinking about it, I was like, I should have just punched him in the face. Like, how dare he do that to my friend? But the first reaction was definitely like, oh my, like, we're strangers here. We don't belong here. And I don't, like, just complete loss of control of the situation.
Because someone just did something that you didn't expect at all, and you've been used to relying on everyone.
Right, basically. To help you out. I mean, and basically just assuming, yeah, that people who look nice are nice, and people in general are nice and are helpful. And I don't know, I guess that was a pretty serious betrayal of this unconscious trust that we had.
I think it was this Thanksgiving break. I was coming home on the Amtrak from New Haven to D.C., and, like, the tunnel was out between Newark and New Jersey, so we all had to, like, wait around for hours we had to, like, make our way to Newark. So it was out between New York and Newark. We had to make our way to Newark, like, through, like, these path commuter trains, and then we had to wait there for hours, and finally when we got on an Amtrak train, it was, like, overcrowded so much. Like, it was just, everyone was jammed in. There were no seats. Everyone was just standing in the aisles. No conductor ever came through. So I was sitting, like, between the backs of two seats. I just sat on the floor. And then this other woman, like, got in there with me. And so we were just, like, sitting there. And we were very much, like, talking about our lives. Like, I'm telling her things, like, that I probably wouldn't tell a lot of my friends about, like, how, you know, I'm moving and, like, what's going on in my parents' lives and why they're going to move to St. Louis and, like, how does that make them feel? And she's talking about, like, her life and, you know, her friends and, But it was interesting because then, like, when we got to Philadelphia, this drunk Eagles fan who was coming home from an Eagles game got on, and he was very clearly drunk, and, like, you got the sense that, like, this, first of all, offended her, that he was drunk to start off with. But he sits down on the aisle, like, in the aisle right next to us, and so he starts talking to us, and he's, like, very outgoing, so he's trying to ask us all his personal questions, but clearly it's just, like, so even though she would, like, open up to me and we were having, like, this very personal conversation, it was just this matter of, like, stranger etiquette. Just, like, the fact that he was drunk and was right away going for, like, the kill with his questions. Like, are you married? Have you ever been married? Like, do you not open up to people? Like, what is this? Why have you never been married? Like, he was going for, like, the personal questions in, like, a very direct way. And she was very clearly, like, completely closed up then. Was like, I don't want to talk to you. Like, like, this is none of your business. And so it's that, like, etiquette of how you approach strangers, mm-hmm. so that you can, like, tap into their niceness.
It's funny, yeah. I mean, I've definitely had canvassers run into real ugly situations out there. I mean, of the four race issues I've ever had my canvassers run into, three of them occurred in Greenwich. One of them involving a fellow driving his truck down the street, throwing things at an Asian girl who we had out there. Yeah, but it's you know, I've seen definitely seen some real good people out there, and also some of the least pleasant people I've run across in Connecticut.
So would you go into anyone's house? Anyone you knocked on their door and they invited you in? Would you go in?
I've always gone into people's houses. You know, I think that's partly because of my size. And I've always sort of taken that as a positive sign. You know, if somebody invites me in, it shows that they trust me. It shows that, you know, they're probably going to give me money. I mean, realistically, if you invite a dude this big into your house, you generally don't send him away without giving him what he's asking for.
Do you tell your canvassers, like, do you have some policy? Like,
we have an official policy against going into houses, which is always tough for me when I'm training people. You know, I go into a house and then tell them, never do what I just did. And then, of course, they all do. But I know that girls in particular are more careful about whose house they're going to go into. And then, you know, everyone goes in, you know, the nice 65-year-old lady's house, because she'll probably give you cookies. gotten a lot of cookies while canvassing, mostly from nice 65-year-old ladies.
The summer after 8th grade, I was at a rainbow gathering, which is essentially about 20,000 people camping in the woods together in the summertime. And
this in Montana? Or?
This actually was in Montana, yeah, 2000. And so I was with my sister and my friend Katie, and then like a couple of guys that we've been like hanging out with that week, and maybe some other people. There's like four or five of us. And we'd gone out into the main meadow, and we'd brought like some sleeping bags, and we were stargazing. It was beautiful. But somehow we all drifted off to sleep. And so we're all sleeping there, and suddenly we wake up to this man just saying like, "Get up! Get up, get up, you gotta get up!" And we're like, what? What do you mean? So, like, I wake up, Katie gets up, my sister's just like, no, I don't want to. This guy's like, you gotta get up! And finally he gets us all, like, rousted up, and we're standing there, and we're like, okay, what's gonna happen next? Like, why did you get us up? So he introduces himself, and he's like, "Hi, I'm Prancing Deer."
"Hi, I'm like, Prancing Deer."
He's like, "Come with me." So we start walking across the meadow, and he's so dramatic. He's like, he'll talk very dramatically, and his movements, you know, just very overemphasized. And so we're walking behind him, and we're all kind of still out of it. We're kind of waking up still in our dream world. And he just, "Halt!" You know, he stops everything, and he says, like, this is, like, the crystal vortex area. And there's actually, like, a medicine pole there, and people have left offerings and such. And he tells this like long and complicated story about how he left a crystal there, and some evil force had come and taken it, and then he'd like gotten it back, and then it was gone again, and now they were after him. Like, there was definitely some sort of level of paranoia, and we're kind of realizing like how out there this man is. And so he's like, "Okay, we continue." So we start walking again, and I don't even remember like what the original premise was for us going with this man, but we were.
Just because he tells you to.
He tells us to, right, and we've been sleeping. And then he halts us again, and he's like, "Be careful. This area has very negative energy. Look at the roots," and it was sagebrush, and there's like this whole root system there. It did, if I remember, it was like strangely colored or something. He's like, so we like tiptoe around it, and you know, you kind of start to believe a thing like this when it's so atmospheric, and he's just fallen from the sky and telling you these insane things. And we go a little bit further. One of us turns on a flashlight or something, and he's like, "Turn that off. Like, people know me here. Like, I can't be seen. Like, I don't know who's after me, but like, let's keep a low profile." Like, oh my God, this man's whacked out. there's a tradition at rainbow gatherings, because there's different campsites all scattered through the woods. People will assemble in a campground, and they'll say, "We love you," and like yell it. And then you hear all scattered throughout the woods, you know, in the nighttime, daytime too, "We love you, we love you." And it's just, it echoes across the meadow. And so he gets us in a circle, and he brings his arms around us, and we're all standing there like clumped together. And he says, "Let's do a quiet we love you." And we're like, "Okay, sure." And then he just, his windpipes just, he let it rip. He just like made us all deaf. It was, "We love you!" And it's a little absurd because there's no audience, really. I mean, it's people, like, at least, like, 500 yards away, and then just us, like, screaming in each other's ears. And then about that time, we had woken up enough to know this man was, like, a character, and, like, perhaps someone we shouldn't show where we're camping, because we were en route to going home, I think. And so, at that point, we're just like, we're going to go our own way, okay? And, okay, prancing deer, and he said, okay. And that was the end of that, but, I mean, my sister and I laughed about that for years, you know, her reluctance to get up, and then once we did, all the craziness that ensued.
I don't know, I feel like strangers are really not all that bad. Like, stranger danger, I don't know.
Yeah, I think most strangers are great. It's just that 1% that
ruins it for everyone.
Yeah.
Because, like, in general, like, you are the stranger. Like, I'm a stranger to everyone who doesn't know me, you know? Like,
mm-hmm.
It's funny, I think my dad's a journalist, and often, because of that, he sort of sees the bad side of strangers. And so I think, I mean, he also has, like, done stories where people, like, have been mad at him. So, like, there have been times when we've been, like, in our house, there have been, like, cars circling and stuff. And, like, it's unclear whether it's actually somebody, like, trying to intimidate him. But, like, it's some, like, it has happened in the past. And he's, like, had to, like, or, like, police, like, for example, like, we've had to call the district and, like, had them come and, like, tell this person to stop, like, stalking the house. So I feel like sometimes where you work or, like, what you do and what you see in your daily life, like, influences you to, like, not trust, like, have a distress for strangers.
You've been listening to The Radley Porch on Yale Radio 1340.
So, over the summer, I went to Germany, and it was my first time abroad by myself, and I was doing a neuroscience internship, and I met this girl named Kulveen at a science conference, and she was Indian American like myself, and we didn't really meet, we just talked for like an hour, but I felt in that hour we really connected, and we parted as like stranger friends. And she lived in Berlin, and I wanted to visit Berlin at one point, and she said I could stay with her. And so I went to Berlin, and I met Kulveen, and her twin brother was also visiting, and their friend named Toast. I never found out Toast's real name, but so I was staying
with... Was Toast an American?
Toast was an American. They were all from D.C. Toast was a tall, white boy from D.C. And Kulveen was really artsy. I really looked up to her, even though I only knew her for like an hour. So it was like Kulveen, the artsy girl, and then me, the artsy wannabe, and then her crazy twin brother and Toast. And we were staying in her apartment, which was like in central Berlin, and she promised me that I'd go to like tons of art museums, etc. And at some point, she was talking about her crazy roommate, who was this 30-year-old bulimic, crazy architect woman. But anyway, later, we were on this roof, and...
Wait, how were you on the roof?
We climbed to the roof.
Okay.
We were staying with... we were over for dinner at Kulveen's friend's house, and this man named Tino was rolling really fat joints, and everyone was smoking them. And at some point, I think close to midnight, Kulveen decided to move out of her apartment. I don't really know how this happened, but...
But the architect was too much for her?
Yeah, she had been living there for like 2 months, and I guess she decided to... She only had 2 more weeks left in the apartment, but with the night on that roof, she decided that she was going to move out. And so I had to stick with her, because I didn't know anything about Berlin. And so at midnight, she started packing, and so did the crazy twin. They were all packing their stuff, and I was just sitting there like, who are these strangers? But I have to stick with them for survival. And then it was a Friday night, and so everyone was sitting out in the bars, and
we were rolling down the cobblestone streets with our, like, 10 suitcases. Kulveen had a lot of stuff that she had accumulated in the last 2 months. And then we traveled to the eastern parts of Berlin, like the suburbs, and that's where there are more neo-Nazis in that area.
Wait, who is she going to stay with?
Oh, so we were going to stay with a friend of hers. Kulveen had many friends. So we were supposed to stay with this friend in the eastern part of Berlin. We get to the apartment, and the friend tells us that she's locked into her apartment. I don't know how that works, but she was locked in because these kids were also visiting her, and they took the key and locked her in, and were not answering the phone. And so we needed to get into the apartment, though. So we had, by this time it was like 3 a.m., and so we had to like climb over a big fence and then like throw all the luggage over the fence. And then to get into the apartment, we had to climb into a balcony. And so Toast just stuck out his hand, and he was like, Aditi, hop on board. And so I sort of, they all like pushed me onto the balcony, and then they gave me all the luggage. And then they said, we have 2 more suitcases back in the apartment. So you stay here and watch the luggage. We'll go back and then come back. So here I was in this apartment. I met the girl, who was another stranger. She was quite nice. And then there was this fat boy babbling on the floor. He, like, I don't have anything against fat people, but I just remember that he was a very big boy, and he was babbling. I just tried to ignore him, and I also slept in the
floor. How old was this boy?
How old? These were all college students.
Okay. So he was, like, your age?
Yeah, maybe, like, 20, 21, babbling.
What was he babbling about?
He was babbling about, well, it was a balcony, and he had been expecting us, and so he wanted to recite the monologue from
Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet. But he said, you came too late. And so I was left here with this boy and this girl. And so I tried to go to sleep.
On the balcony?
No, by this time I'd moved from the balcony past the babbling boy to an inner room. He was sitting by the balcony still, though. And, well, at like 5:45, Kulveen calls me again. And she says, we had an encounter with neo-Nazis on the way back, and it's really awful, and we'll come in the morning and get you. That's a dangerous place to stay. So now I'm having a panic attack because I don't know any German. I'm in Berlin with these strangers. And
surrounded by neo-Nazis.
Yeah, now they're neo-Nazis. What happened was, I found out later, was that Kulveen and her brother and Toast were all on the subway going back to their apartment, and 3 neo-Nazis came on the subway and were beating up a punk who sat next to them. I don't really know the difference. Neo-Nazis tend to dress similarly to punks, but they don't like each other. So they were beating up this guy, and Kulveen and her brother, they're Indian, so they were really scared of getting beat up as well. Toast was just looking on at the whole scene. At one point, though, the neo-Nazis, they got off, and then the subway conductor closed the doors on them, and so they couldn't get back on. But everyone was scared after that. And so in the morning, I took a shower, I had breakfast, and everything was okay, and they came to get me. Well, I thought everything was okay. And we moved all the luggage back to the old apartment, and we had a nice day. Like, I think we went to one art museum, so the stranger fulfilled some of her promises. But at some point that night, well, we went out to some places that night, and we came back, and when I was in the shower the next morning, I heard screaming. When I came out of the shower, the crazy roommate and Kulveen were arguing heatedly in German, and Kulveen came back to the room in tears and said we had to move out immediately.
Again.
And we had all just unpacked again. And at this point, I decided that I really didn't know Kulveen, and even though she was really artsy and cool, that I wasn't risky enough for these people, or I wasn't adventurous enough for these people, and I just wanted to be safe and be stable and see more art museums. So I found a hostel, and I separated from my stranger friends, and I did talk to them one more time. She called me the next day to go to a gay karaoke bar. But I declined.
What do you think was, what was it about her that you connected so well in that 1 hour that you would go on this, like, 2-day trip
with her and keep sticking to her?
I actually think it was just that in Germany, I hadn't met any other Indians or Indian Americans, and she was the first one. It was sort of like we both had the sense of being part of like a diaspora, as cheesy as it sounds. And also the fact that both of us were really interested in art and also science. I mean, we had met at a science conference. And even once when I was on a bus, and I was going to work in Germany, and this girl got on the bus, and she looked South Asian, and I guess there was, like, this South Asian connection, and she sat near me, we both got off at the same stop, and she said something to me in German, but I heard it as, "Do you understand Tamil?" And Tamil is a language spoken in Sri Lanka and South India, and I speak it at home. So she spoke to me in German, but I definitely heard Tamil. And I answered her in Tamil. She was very confused. But then we started speaking in Tamil, and she switched to German, and I said, "No, I don't understand any German." And we made a connection, though. It was really nice. I mean, we were strangers. But we went to H&M. We bonded over shopping and Tamil and other things. But again, yeah, so I've made the diaspora connection again.
No, I think that makes sense. Like, if you go abroad, even if you meet another American, like, normally in the U.S., this is not someone you would ever hang out with or be friends with, but suddenly if you're abroad, you're like, "Oh, you're an American." Or, like, in Brazil one day in this market, I ran into this kid who goes to Yale, who, like, we had a very maybe, like, nodding acquaintance at Yale. But seeing him in this market in Brazil, it was like, "Oh, so good to see you!" Like, I think there is a sense abroad, like, connections like that.
So when you guys are backpacking, do you pretty much, if you see someone, they're camping, you would trust them, you would ask them for help, you would help them, you would...
I mean, more than somebody on the street in New Haven, probably.
I feel like there's sort of a self-selection of the people you meet out on a trail are people who, you know, you assume you have a certain commonality of interest with. You know, they're not coming out in the backcountry to do criminal things, and you know, yeah, I trust them.
I guess there's comfort in just having another human there in case you run out of water or get in trouble.
You can always slit him open and crawl inside of the wharf. For a resource as well as companionship.
I sometimes lie to strangers. In buses, airplanes, trains, like places where you're like confined with someone.
And they're like, "Hey, what's your life story?"
A period of time, yeah. Like, I actually... Often I tell the truth, but usually it starts out with, like, "So, you're a student, like, where do you go to school?" And, like, there's often a lot of situations where I don't want to say I go to Yale, or, like, somehow that embarrasses me. So I'll start out by saying, you know, "I go to school at UConn," or "I go to school at, like, you know, University of Colorado," or, "Yeah, I go to Pomona," or, like, just some random school, and from there, somehow it seems like, once I make that step, then I just sort of have to...
Fall off.
Right, I just have to, like, create another... So, like, I'll have... Like, I sat next to this guy on a plane ride back to Denver, and I said that I went to school at BU, and I was, like, an architecture major, which I'm not. I'm a political science major, basically. And so, like... And then I had, like, a sister who was a year younger than me, which is just completely not true. And that, like, my parents are not from, that I was going out to ski in Colorado. Anyway, instead of like, basing my home in Colorado. And it was really funny because he opened up to me, too. Like, we had, like, this great discussion about his life. And I sometimes wonder if that was a complete lie, like, a complete fabrication as well.
Your lies make you doubt what other strangers
right.
say to you.
Right. And, like, not that I was, like, intentionally trying to mislead him in some sort of, like, malicious sense. Like, there's no... I mean, I obviously haven't seen him since and probably won't or would recognize him if I did. But, like, it's funny sort of what barriers... What's, like, what things you can do with strangers that you would never think of doing with someone who you, like, are meeting in, like, a context in which you expect to meet them again.
That's totally true. Like, there's something about talking to strangers that it's kind of a free-for-all. The idea that I will never see this person again, so we can do the craziest things and it won't matter.
Especially while traveling, because
yeah.
if you're in transit somewhere, especially, there's probably not a big chance that you're gonna meet up with that person again.
So I was on this flight from Chicago to New York,
And I was sitting next to this guy who was, like, late 30s. And the two of us didn't talk at all until when we were, like, you know, circling to land. It was the very end of the flight. And for some reason, I just turned to him and I said, so, like, what brings you to New York? You know, business or pleasure? And he said, oh, I'm here on business. And I thought, oh, that's nice. Like, what do you do? And he looked at me and he just said, deadpan, I hunt people. And so, yeah, he was a bond hunter. And he started telling me these crazy stories of how he had, you know, he had just gotten a bulletproof vest from his buddy and he'd been shot at and all these things. And I remember as we were getting off the plane, he turned to me and he said, this time, it's a little Filipino lady. And then he was off.
So did you feel like taking out some ads, be like, little Filipino ladies, watch out.
Beware! No, and actually, you know, going back to the comment on, like, you'll share more things with strangers than maybe you would with the person you're meeting for the first time and expect to meet again. He was telling me how he has these abilities to search for people. And I've never met my biological father. So I was like, hey, I know. I'll give you his social security number and you can run a background check on my dad and see if he pops up. Which, in retrospect, is like
way
so
too much
time. Yeah, and it's very strange that I would feel comfortable doing that.
Have you guys ever done couch surfing before?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting thing. A, like how you make the connection, right? Because you kind of send out these... Well, to give a background, Couchsurfing is an online network and kind of like Facebook in that you have a profile and then you and you offer a couch for any travelers who are in your neighborhood, and then in exchange you get a couch hopefully when you want to travel somewhere as well. And so the way you make these connections is you basically just email people that you're friends with on the site, or you email strangers, and you have to kind of give a blurb about yourself. It's kind of like selling yourself and saying, like, I'm a safe person. And it's not that bad when you're, like, a 21, 22-year-old girl from America. Like, people usually are pretty receptive. So it's sending out those emails are kind of, like, this bizarre thing.
Last spring break, I went to Amsterdam, and I couch surfed in Amsterdam with one of my friends from school. And she actually went out a couple days before me because I had stopped off to see a friend in England. And so when I arrived, she'd been, like, staying with this guy. And she's like, you can stay too. He said, it's fine. I said, perfect, let's go. I mean, I didn't know him. She didn't know him. But she'd been staying with him. So we go to this place, and he hasn't met me yet. I don't know where he was. And I just, like, fall asleep because I'd had to do, like, this overnight stay in the airport. But it was the coolest thing. Like, he was this bohemian through and through who was squatting in this apartment. He didn't even pay for his water bill. He had no money at all. But he had, like, this big art project, of course. Like, this mural that he just started on the wall. It was, like, it was out of a book or something. And he was, like, thin, and he had his hat and his, like, coat and his little, like, satchel kind of thing. And he was very soft-spoken, but very... to the point. I don't know, I think the Dutch, like, will just say it how it is. And so, yeah, he came home and he met me and it was fine, and I tried to give him some candy that he was not interested in, and then he served us, like, whole grain bread with cheese, and we're like, yeah. And then he took us out to this free jazz, well, it wasn't jazz exactly, it was just improvisational. I guess that comes out of jazz, but it was improvisational through and through. It was a concert. And it was right on the water in this, like, brand new building. It was this just huge block on the water, and it was very bizarre architecturally. And we're sitting in there, and I'm just, like, having this moment, like, wow, reorienting myself. Like, I'm in Amsterdam. These people are improvising in front of me. Sometimes it sounds awful. Sometimes it's, like, life-changing. The music's so, like, soaring, you know, into the air. And I'm sitting here with Dawei on my left, staying at his squatter apartment. It was so bizarre. And then he's like, okay, now let's go to the underground radio. So we're like, okay. But by underground, he meant both literally and figuratively. So it's like the last underground radio station of Amsterdam. And we go, and he's got all these friends. And so you have to, like, walk through this compound that has all this graffiti and such, and then you go down these stairs and you like say a little password and they let you into the recording studio, and it's very cramped, and we get there and they've been like on the air for a while now, and he's got like 5 or 6 friends there, and they're drinking all these beers, and there's this big Greek guy is rolling all these spliffs like one after another after another. And they put us on the air, me and Pop, and they're like, so what's it like to be American? And we get all these crazy questions, and then we start kind of getting goofy and like telling stories where you say a couple sentences and then pass the microphone. And it was like something about these leaflets, pamphlets that were scattered everywhere, and then like a boat made out of pizzas, and a shark came, and a sperm whale, I think it was, and like, just, I don't know, it was bizarre. It was like, it was so great though, that you can just put yourself out there and the stranger will be there for you, and it's so much, I mean, it's a lot of trust. You really have to, be able to like read people, you have to be able to follow your instincts, like know your gut, like, I mean, it helps if you do it with someone else. But I also think it's an amazingly beautiful thing that there is that network out there and that, you know, that we're, like, at that point.
It really is.
Humanity.
But it is crazy. My first couchsurfing experience was in Paris.
Yeah.
And I was doing this by myself because I had a friend in Paris, but she was at a homestay and she didn't really have room for me and I didn't want to impose.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, it's okay, I'll do couchsurfing. So I did it with this 21-year-old guy. He had this little attic apartment, not a separate bedroom, it's just like one room. And I was going to be there for 4 days. And I knew all this information beforehand. And I was like, okay, I think I can do this. This will be fun. He's this anthropology person. Like, he'll show me around the city. It'll be cool. And I get there, and it's actually, like, really hard to get in touch with him. Like, somehow between, like, me not having a cell phone and, like, me trying to call with a payphone, it was just not working out well. We finally meet up at a metro station, and I'm walking with him, and, like, I see him for the first time, and I'm like, what have I gotten myself into? He's this guy with, like, hair down to his butt, and, like, this weird goatee, wearing, like, band capris, and, like, just, he just seems really confused with, like, the world. he's like, I think my apartment's this way, and, like, he's taking me, and I'm like, this is possibly not even him. Like, he could not have an apartment. I'm just following him. What am I doing with my life? But we finally, like, get up to the place, and he like, his friend is there, and they, like, start smoking marijuana, and they're like, do you want some? I'm like, I've just been on the plane for the last, like, 8 hours. I'm not going to start off not knowing you and just smoking. So it was just, like, one of, like, this crazy moment, and I just decided to, like, leave and, like, hang out in this garden for just, like, center myself for a little bit. And then I go back, and we, like, finally actually start talking. And he's just really interested in the United States and just, I don't know, it was just a moment where I was like, oh, this guy is fine. He's just, like, another person, like, who just lives maybe slightly differently than I do, but it'll be okay. And so we ended up getting along supremely well. And I think it also helped because I gave him a CD. I knew he liked ska music. And I had a bunch of ska music. And I gave him Real Big Fish, basically. And that, like, smoothed everything over. It's like, you just need that one ladder, basically, to like, connect you to, like, two people. And, like, then you're fine. I think that is really key, is the CD.
I have a couchsurfing profile, and I often get requests. But since I live in a house of 8, we kind of have to do this clearance where everyone agrees that it's okay to open our house up to it. And there's actually been, like, a lot of opposition, and people, one person in particular just asked that we not host people, which is understandable because we've got these busy schedules or whatever. So anyway, there was this guy, Franz, who requested to stay in our house. And his picture is just, like, close up. It's not very flattering. He's bald. He's maybe in his 50s or so. He's from Buenos Aires in Argentina.
I think I got the same request.
Yeah, perhaps so. It was just very bizarre. So he requested to stay at our house, and I, like, forwarded the request to the house, and people said, I don't know about him. Like, we shouldn't feel obligated to host just anybody. But me being the bleeding heart that I am, I was like, well, I'll at least tell him that we can get together for coffee when he comes through. So we meet up for coffee, and within, like, 2 minutes of me sitting down, the reason he came is he's very interested in theater, so he wanted to know more about Yale, like, School of Drama and meet some professors and maybe do some like one-on-one tutorials with them. And I wasn't actually that clear on why he came, because he was, I asked him, I said, so you're going to be applying here? He said, no, I'm already like practicing. I'm a professional. I'm just meeting people. It was, I guess it was networking or something, but it was very bizarrely done. So within 2 minutes of sitting down in Book Trader in the coffee shop, I said, hey, there's a really cool lecture going on right now. I can just take you to it. So I take him to the lecture. I'm like, but I've got to go. So just talk to that guy when you're done. And I point to my friend Adam, who I also live with. And I said, he knows a lot about drama. He can, like, you know, field your questions, and I think it's a good match. So I snuck out of the lecture. And, you know, Franz found him afterwards, and they had their conversation or whatever. And then about 3 weeks later, I come home from God knows where. I come in the door, and Adam and Franz are sitting on our, like, in our living room. And I'm walking through the living room to get to my bedroom, and I said, oh, hi. And he looks up, and he says, like, Angel? And I said, yeah. And he goes, you live here too? And I guess I had made it very clear that Adam and I weren't just friends, that we lived together. And I said, yeah. And he's like, oh, I didn't realize that. So he was a little disoriented by that. And then I said, I wish I could hang out, but I really have to memorize my lines for the show. And, you know, keeping in mind that his one aim was drama, and that I guess I had, like, somehow forgot to mention that I also, like, do drama. He was like, wait, you act? You so live here and you act? And he was the funniest thing, because I didn't mean to misrepresent myself, but I guess I had. And he said, I'm at once very intrigued and angry at you. And so I said, I'm sorry. And we never really had our sit-down conversation because he was on his way back to Argentina. But it was just one of those things where you never know when you're going to see that person again. Oh, Franz. I mean, that's what makes couchsurfing possible. I mean, I don't know, I just, when you stop and think about it, that you could just, like, offer your couch up to someone because they also like anthropology. I think it's just a new way of, like, conceiving of meeting people. Why are you so far away?
New Haven, 1340 AM. If you have any comments, suggestions, or submissions, please contact us at theradleyporch@gmail.com.
Do you guys have friends at home that you know ridiculously well? Like, you know stories about them that, like, maybe no one else knows, but, like, yet when you go home and see them, they still somehow feel like a stranger at times.
And how do you explain these strangers in your new life to your old friends?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it is, you can kind of try and sum up, I mean, I've got this great friend, John, at school, and he's from Colorado, and after a while, to your friends, I'm just saying, blah, 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 and, yeah, you kind of have to just let go, and, like, just be where you are, and kind of understand that if their paths are going to cross, it'll happen in person, and you can do what you can with your words, but you can't actually explain away
Right, you can't make your worlds join, like, because sometimes you go home and you've maybe kept in touch with people, some or not that well, and, you know, like, your friends have started these new friendships and new relationships in their lives, and you're like, I have no idea what's going on, but, like, so then, you know, they do feel, like, so much about you, maybe you've grown up and changed in ways that I don't understand yet, but, like, we still have this common history, and so, like, I still feel friendship.
Mm-hmm. What's really strange is meeting, is when the worlds actually do come together. Because then you feel like, or I've had an experience where, like, I felt like I actually don't have any friends at all. Like, they're all strange to me. Because one set of friends, like, knows me in this context, and one set of friends knows me in the other, and they clearly didn't get along when they met. Like, it was not.
Are these friends from home?
These are friends from home and school. And actually, there were two friends from middle school, two friends from high school, and two friends from college. and I went to different middles. Like, my middle school and high school friends didn't overlap really either. Although they had more, I guess, commonalities because they were both Denver friends. But so, like, we sort of all randomly ended up at a bar, and, like, it was very clear that, like, there were distinct, like, dislikes, like, instantly when my friends met. And it was really strange to me to be like, well, I like both of you, like, but you know me in different contexts and clearly don't like either the person that I've become in the other context or, like, or my friends that I've made. In
so did you feel like they represented different parts of you, or?
I mean, I didn't think so. I mean, I would like to think that I haven't changed all that much. but I think, I mean, it was, like, this very scary moment where I sort of had to reassess who I associated with in these different contexts and who I was
right.
as a person in these different contexts.
Well, and also, like, the fact that your friends from Colorado and your friends from Yale weren't really willing to, like, for the sake of John, come and find that common ground.
Right.
Yeah,
that they could write each other off, and it kind of leaves you out in the cold because
yeah.
you're the uniting force, and
right.
so then, like, are you supposed to side with one side,
yeah.
or do you have to, like, you know, explain yourself
yeah.
now, or, yeah.
And it wasn't like a showdown or something. It was just clear, and everybody was very, like, cordial, but it was just clear that they all, like, disliked each other. Like, they didn't find anything interesting about the other.
So the rest of the night was just kind of awkward and...
Yeah, it was strange. I ended up leaving with my college friends because they were visiting me, and it was sort of like, you know, my other sort of sets of friends had their own sets of friends there in Denver, so it seemed...
Right, you were hosting the college friends.
Yeah. But it was a strange experience to sort of to see that. I think it's also funny, like, what causes one to open up, like, actually open up to a stranger. Like, the smallest things, like, Aditi was talking about how, like, the fact that somebody was South Asian, like, makes her talk. And, like, it's funny, like, that ladder that you were saying can be so small. Like, somebody, this was on a on a train from Rome to Sicily when I was traveling a couple summers ago. And this person opened up Dante, one of, I think it was Purgatory, he was Italian, and obviously, I mean, that's, like, in Italy, like, the most common book ever, but suddenly I felt like I needed to, like, talk to him, and that, like, was the, we had been sitting on the train for, like, 2 hours before that, and we hadn't said a word to each other, maybe, like, hello or something, and as soon as he opened up that book, it seemed like suddenly I wanted to approach him, which is sort of a strange thing to, like, suddenly decide that like he's worth my time because he's reading this book with him, or like he's like interesting to me suddenly because he's got a book that I've read. But it is, even like that tiny little piece of commonality is enough to
mm-hmm. Was it like now you felt interested in talking to him, or now you felt like you had a conversation opener?
Yeah,
or both?
It was I think it's a little bit of both, but I think like that conversation opener is also for me at least sort of hard to start with strangers unless there's some sort of something that you can spark conversation with, because
mm-hmm.
I'm not very good at just sort of, like, I guess what you said, like, going for the kill immediately, like,
why have you never been married?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that reminds me of another story, actually, but I think the thing is, most tourists, I would say, in this country, or Chinese speakers in this country also speak English, and probably speak English better than I speak Chinese, but they're sort of intrigued by the fact that I speak Chinese more than anything, and that sort of sparks the interaction. So it's not really for practical reasons, you know, like I wouldn't have been able to communicate with them otherwise. It's that, you know, they wouldn't have chosen me to interact with.
But because you have that connection.
But because we have that connection, right. Like, for example, I was sitting in Ivy Noodle, actually, with two of my friends who I had studied with in China, and since when we studied in China, we had a language pledge, we only spoke Chinese to each other. A lot of times, back at school, we would speak Chinese to each other just for fun or just to stay in practice, and that was how we were used to communicating with each other. So the three of us are sitting in Ivy Noodle speaking Chinese, bad Chinese, obviously, and or like Chinglish, really. And this woman comes over, and she says, in English, but it's clear that she's a native Chinese speaker, like, I couldn't help overhearing, and I'm so surprised to find the three of you speaking Chinese here, like, can I sit down and talk to you? And so she sits down and starts talking with us in Chinese. She's a professor from a university in Texas, I think. a professor of Chinese literature who's in the U.S. for our conference. And so we talk with her about, you know, our studying Chinese. And then we find out she's giving a talk the next day. We're like, oh, we should go see it. And it turned out that she was actually a friend of my Chinese literature professor and all of our Chinese language professors, but an old friend of my Chinese literature professor. And my Chinese lit professor had actually asked, you know, told the class that we should come see this talk. And so we went to see it the next day, and we talked to her, and all of our Chinese professors were there, and they were so impressed that we had been speaking Chinese in a restaurant, and that's how she had met us. And she was, you know, telling them about how our Chinese was so great and how we used these, like, archaic expressions, which probably just means that we had been taught these, like, non-colloquial expressions. We're using them colloquially because we, like, don't know what we're doing. But she was so, you know, she was like, Yale has such a great Chinese program, and she was telling this to our language professor. So we, like, gave face to our language professors and ourselves, obviously. I don't know. It was great.
Well, I remember one summer I was on it. So I just moved, like, a semester before to a new school, and I was on a bus that summer, like, going into the city to volunteer at this place. And I saw this boy who I knew went to the new school. Like, we had never talked, but I just kind of recognized him from around the school. But I wasn't, like, going to just start talking to him. But then he started reading this book that I knew was, like, summer reading for the school. So then it could be like, oh, do you go to Springbrook? Like, I see you're reading this book, like, assigned reading, and then we kind of started this awkward, I mean, that was, so we then stayed, like, friends for the next 2 years, but it was this very awkward period of, like, we were both pretty much always every day on the same bus, but, like, during that first conversation, we didn't ask each other's names, so then, like, the next day, we, like, didn't talk to each other again, and then after that, we would, like, sometimes talk to each other, but not, and even, like, I think I asked his name, but didn't tell him mine, and it was this very bizarre, like, we know we're going to the same school, but, like, we're not really getting past the stranger point yet. We're still, like, strangers talking on a bus.
What do you think is the defining moment where you pass the stranger? Like, when does a stranger become a friend?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this is always the 100% of the time, but then, like, so then seeing him in school the next semester, so maybe something about, like, seeing someone again or, like, in a different context. Then you, like, now we have multiple, we don't just sit next to each other on an airplane, but we also go to the bar together in Berlin. There are stranger friends that, like, you know you're never going to meet again, but you still feel like you have this connection to. But I think to transition just into, like, a normal friend is this, you've set up some kind of, like, we're going to see each other again. Like, this is a relationship that's going to continue. I think that's the, like, crucial transition.
Yeah. It's interesting, like, when you do meet these strangers and have these conversations, like, if you do continue your contact, or if you just have a clean break. I'm thinking back on this train ride that I took across the country when I was maybe 8 years old. It was my dad and my little brother and I, and it was the Christmas holiday, so the train was packed. And so, of course, my little brother sat with my dad, and I was kind of, like, gregarious, outgoing little 8-year old. Who sat next to this old woman named Pearl. And Pearl and I just, man, we hit it off. We had such a great time. I think we had maybe like 9 hours of conversation straight. Just blah, 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 blah. And she had to get off in the middle of the night. Her stop was somewhere along the way. And then my stop was later. So she had drifted off to sleep. And I thought, I really want to keep in touch with Pearl. So I wrote down her little address. And I was like slipping it into her purse and she woke up. She was like, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm giving you my address. And she was like, oh, you're such a doll. You know, we had that little moment. And then I fell asleep, and the next thing I knew, she was gone. She'd gotten off, and you kind of have that sense of loss. And, you know, there goes Pearl. And I really had no idea if she'd contact me. I probably even forgot that I'd given her my address. But the next holiday came, and I got this holiday card with, like, a crisp $5 bill. And she would, for the holiday, she would match the stickers. So if it's St. Patrick's Day, there's little, like, shamrocks for the stickers. And she'd, you know, say, to Angel, XOXO Pearl. And I got this card. And then from then on, like, every holiday, I would get a card from Pearl.
And it would be my birthday, there'd be more money. Or...
Wait, she knew your birthday?
I think she knew my birthday. It was a while ago, but she would send me cards for, like, not Labor Day. It was never, like, that extreme, but...
That's St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patrick's Day, Easter, Thanksgiving, even, and...
Did you write back to her?
Yeah, I would write her back, and I would include my, like, school picture from that year, and I'd say, like, I'm in fifth grade now, and this is what I do, and I'd ask her all these questions about herself, and I maybe sent two or three kind of, like, full-page letters. And she would never write back with details. I would just get another card, and it would just say XOXO Pearl. And it was, like, so strange to have this one experience, but then to have no substantive correspondence. But yet to
especially
feel,
if,
like,
you're putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
Right, being, like...
And then, but to feel this, like, love from this, like, old motherly woman somewhere in Illinois sending me these cards, and then... Sometime in high school, I got an obituary in the mail.
Oh.
Yeah, and her family somehow knew that I'd want that closure, and that she was corresponding with me, even though she never really wrote anything more than her name.
So that means she must have mentioned you to her family.
Yeah.
Strangers in the night, exchanging glances, wandering in the night. What were the chances we'd be sharing love before the night was through?
Our final section today is a passage from Homer's Iliad. It shows us since ancient times, strangers have been drawn together. Two strangers of opposing armies meet on the battlefield for the first time. As they prepare to run their spears through each other, Glaucus shares his lineage.
When he heard that, Diomedes' spirits lifted. Raising his spear, the lord of the war cry drove it home, planting it deep down in the earth that feeds us all. And with winning words, he called out to Glaucus, the young captain, "Splendid! You are my friend! My guest from the days of our grandfathers long ago! Noble Aeneas hosted your brave Bellerophon once. He held him there in his halls 20 whole days, and they gave each other handsome gifts of friendship. My kinsman offered a gleaming sword belt, rich red. Bellerophon gave a cup, two-handled, solid gold. I left it at home when I set out for Troy. My father, Tydeus, I don't really remember. I was just a baby when father left me then. At that time, an Achaean army went to die at Thebes. So now I'm your host and friend in the heart of Argos, and you are mine in Lycia when I visit your country. Come, let us keep clear of each other's spears, even there in the thick of battle. Look, plenty of Trojans there for me to kill. Your famous allies, too. Any soldier the god will bring in range, or I can run down. And plenty of Argives, too. Kill them if you can. But let's trade armor. The men must know our claim. We are sworn friends from our father's days till now."
Joining us on the Radley Porch as we talk about strangers on Yale Radio 1340.
Join us next week, same time, same place, when we talk about the little childhood traumas that still stay with us.